Williams, Reel 3. It's the pig story.
On the appointed day, I went back, because the pig was usually killed the day before and hung up overnight, and they were the half piece, and we collected the half piece. And then it all had to be cut up, and one learned quite a lot about the anatomy of animals doing that. And then I arrived on the doorstep to be greeted by the lady in floods of tears, absolutely floods of tears. And she said, "Oh, I couldn't kill Boo Boo. I couldn't possibly have eaten Boo Boo, so I've given him away." So that was the end of that one. But it was quite, the bacon curing was a useful thing. It was a very good thing because the men were interested in bacon curing, men in the village produce associations and allotment associations and so on, who were probably keeping a pig somewhere, and they were interested. So it was a very good thing.
And would they do that in their own kitchens then?
In their own kitchens, yeah.
How would they do that? How would they cure bacon?
It was a longish sort of process. You chopped it up into reasonable sizes, usually a ham, a shoulder, a belly, a back, and then everything else, the other bits that you had. You could cure cheeks too. And everything else went into pork pies, sausages, matrimony cake, faggots, and you were expected to be able to help the household with dealing with. Whoever was doing it would get two or three friends in, and they'd come and help. But you had to rub the salt into the meat, and it really had to be rubbed in. And it was quite tough work, and it was a good thing to have several people there to deal with it. The funniest one I ever had, and it really was a funny one, was in Montgomery in Wales, and I arrived towards the end of the afternoon, just as the evening was sort of coming in, and it was a hill farm. And I was met at the bottom of the drive, the long sort of lane up to the farm, by the woman of the house, who said, "Oh, Miss Williams, I thought I had better warn you. My husband does not like the English." And so we went up to the farm, and we went into the kitchen where supper was in process, and they were all eating faggots. So I knew the pig was dead. But I'm not very fond of faggots, so, but there was dead silence. We just sat there and ate. And suddenly the man looked up and he said, "Do you know A.G. Street?" And Pounder was at school with me. I'd been brought up with the streets, and I knew very well. I mean, A.G. was quite a friend of mine, Arthur. And so I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh." And then we all went back to our faggots. And a few minutes later, he said, "Did you see the funeral of George the Sixth?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, that is all right then." And it was. He couldn't have been more helpful. Now, what A.G. Street and George the Sixth had to do with a Welsh hill farm, I just don't know. But he helped us. He helped us carry the pig. He helped us do it. He was very helpful. But what, as I say, George the Fifth, George the Sixth, and A.G. Street had to do with him, I have no idea. But even the next day was funny because we did the pig in a very small, very small outhouse, and all the village had come, and they were all Welsh speaking, Montgomery, and I was busy trying to demonstrate what you did with this, and every time I wanted anything, it had to be handed over. Everybody said it was just jam packed, and everything had to be handed over to me to sort of deal with it like that, and so on and so forth. And I was busy sort of explaining that this is what you did, and this is what you did, and that's what you did. And I suddenly realised that they were all talking Welsh, and whether they were listening to me or not, I don't know. So I switched to French, and nobody noticed the difference. noticed the difference, and we had a wonderful, absolutely wonderful pig cure. But I always remember that one. And but again, you see, you never know, because one of the women who was there, I went back to her several times because she lived just outside Bala, and I used to go and stay if I was doing something up in that part of the world. I would just go and stay with her. So I mean, it all sort of works in.
Did many people have pigs? You know, this system of keeping a pig.
I wouldn't say a lot of people did, but it was definitely something that happened.
And would it mainly have been in rural areas?
Not entirely, but almost entirely. I doubt very much whether people in towns would have been very pleased about having pig sort of floating around there. But a lot of people did keep pigs. But and quite a lot of people kept pigs and poultry and cattle on allotments. It was stopped immediately after the war, or at least almost immediately after the war. But at the time, if somebody had an allotment and they wanted to keep pigs or poultry or cattle on it, or heifers, not so much big cattle, but little cattle, or goats, they could use allotments. It was food production, you see. It didn't matter very much what it was food production. And allotments were supposed to be for food production. And it didn't go on very long after the war, not with that, because by that time there was a tremendous lot of people of house building going on, and allotments were prime targets for house building. They still are.
How about rabbits?
Yes, rabbits. Usually the kids looked after the rabbits. It wasn't one of the things that immediately comes to mind as being one of the things that were grown, largely because there were, in those days, you see, there were a hell of a lot of wild rabbits, and there was a lot of trapping, went on with wild rabbits. I think you could usually get a rabbit in a market, a wild rabbit. It certainly wasn't a major source of food production. I've met it since in other countries as a major source of food production, but I don't think it was at that time, because there were lots of rabbits.
Well, was there any worry about sort of animal diseases with people sort of having them privately? Did you have to check up on animal welfare, if there is such
a... There were always vets available. The agricultural department always had vets available if necessary. But the only thing that really hit anyone of us was Newcastle disease in poultry. And once they discovered they'd got an injection that they could do that, you usually got your poultry injected, and that was that. But there were vets available on the War Agricultural Committee, and people weren't conscious of things like allergies and animal transmitted diseases or anything. We'd all been brought up, certainly in the rural areas, that you lived with animals and you ate everything that was put in front of you, and allergies and animal related diseases weren't even around. I mean, they weren't even thought about, hadn't even been invented.
How about going back to your pigs, the slaughtering? Did they have to go away?
They went to a proper slaughterhouse. But there were slaughterhouses everywhere in those days. Nowadays, they've been cut down until cows now have to go 200 miles to be slaughtered, which is absolutely ridiculous. But in those days, there were slaughterhouses almost everywhere, and they were properly done. I mean, there was always somebody sort of keeping an eye on them. And you could always tell when you got your pig whether it had been properly done or not, as to whether it was properly bled and whether it was all sort of clean and so on. So it was all bite it and think there was no bother with it.
Was horse meat eaten in the war?
I suppose so.
Did that come into your scheme of things?
It didn't come into me at all, but that would have been on the angry side. And I certainly wasn't. I mean, we knew about, we ate whale meat and things, but horse meat, you see, a lot of the horses had to go, which there wasn't any cavalry, not after about the first six or seven months, there wasn't any cavalry. And so I think a lot of the horses were gradually sort of put down. You certainly didn't see an awful lot of horses around unless they were actually doing a job of work. If they were drawing a tractor or a plough or something, well then that was a different matter, and they were usually a different sort of horse anyway. But horses were not a frivol.
This car you had and your driving, I imagine you had a petrol allowance.
Yes.
Is that right? You would have.
I was just trying to think. When did I get my? I got my first car when I was down in Somerset, where you could get. Well, in those days, then you could get a very small private allowance for petrol. But when I went on to the Wilkes War Egg, we had a definite allowance there. You had to, very strict regulations about keeping your mileage and how much petrol you used, and you've got so many petrol coupons from the office. That also, in a cockeyed way, was quite an education, because we had on our little team of four or five, we had a young man called Pete, who drove an open, very elegant sports car, and he adored it, and he tinkered with it, and he could play with it, and he knew all about its innards, and he got it so fine down that he could drive on the absolute minimum of petrol. And so, being a virtuous young man, when he sent his returns in, he said that he'd done so many miles on so much petrol. And he had a note back from the office saying, "You can't possibly have done this. Would you please send your proper records in?" He said, "Right, if that's what they want, I'm going to use the rest of it for pleasure." He did. honestly, it doesn't always pay. But we had a very good man there who was on small holdings with us. He was on small holdings, and he had been largely instrumental at the end of the First World War, when a lot of the soldiers came back to 10 acres and a cow, or 5 acres and a cow, whatever it was, and they were given they weren't trained, they didn't know the countryside, they couldn't get, and there were all these little settlements set up all over the country for this 5 acres and a six, I think it was 10 acres and a cow. And the bloke that I was working with had been very much involved in that. And so he got a very interesting background from that point of view. And he went on, and he met when the War Agricultural Committee broke up, he went on to doing that similar kind of work after the Second World War, so we're up in Essex. And he's quite well known for it, actually. And we were a nice gang. And
would you have been officially, you know, part of the Dig for Victory? Was this a big part of it?
Oh yes, we were very much all the War Agricultural Committees. We were very much part of the Dig for Victory, the Grow for Victory. We were digging because most of the people we dealt with were digging rather than tractoring. But it was absolutely tremendous. The surge of growing vegetables and fruit, for and the the collection of anything wild that could be collected, that could be made into a preserve or into a street or something. Rosehip snipes, we used to collect rosehips till we were out of, till we were, they were coming out of our ears almost, because rosehip syrup was a good source of vitamin C, and when you couldn't get cod liver oil, you had rosehip syrup. And
was that made in a factory?
No, you did that. No, it could be made in a factory. If there was a factory near you, then you collected your rosehips and you took them into the factory. But a lot of people made it themselves. But they were horrible things to do, because the inside of a rose hip is nasty. It's all little hairs, and you had to get rid of all the little hairs. It wasn't nice to do, but the result was all right. And you used hips and oars and elderberries and blackberries, and you went mushrooming like mad, and anything that you could get, nuts. It was a constant battle between the squirrels and the people for nuts everywhere. I think we were all very conscious that we had got a responsibility for getting as much food out of the ground, out of the land as we possibly could. And at the same time, I think most of us had felt a responsibility that we not only got to get as much out, we had got to ensure that we left the ground, whether they were little private houses or allotments or big farms, that we left the ground as in a good state. There was a great effort to put certainly organic matter as much as possible back into the ground.
Would it mainly have been organic then? You know, if you're thinking mainly, of fertilising,
unless you were doing say tomatoes or lettuce or something that was that probably needed inorganic, in which case you could probably get inorganic, but a lot of the inorganic you couldn't get because the ships weren't allowed to carry it. So if it wasn't local stuff that you could get sort of locally, like chalk, on acid soils. Otherwise, it was as much as possible. I mean, the experiments that went on during the war with what you could do with straw to get it, because your straw doesn't rot down easily, and therefore if you put it into the ground, it didn't rot easily. And it needed a lot of water, and water wasn't always available where it was needed. But the thing that we tried to do with straw, we tried chopping it up, we tried putting it in layers, we tried mulching with it, we tried everything possible with straw, and the damn stuff wouldn't rot. But we did try to do our bit by the ground. I think most of us had a feeling that the ground was doing its best by us, and we got to do our best by it.
What was the view on human soil? You know, to use that as
Well, if you lived in a village, it was probably what you got. Certainly, it wasn't until the 40, until about 48, 49, that we had a water supply in my village, and we had a privy down the garden, and everything out of the privy went into the garden, and you just didn't, you never thought twice about it. I mean, if the turnips grew better in that, well, it did. And of course, when I went out to Korea later, everything was human, the human and the other there. Everything that went back in was. But, I think everybody just automatically did. And there were noise and things that came around and collected, and a lot of people had septic tanks or soakaways. But we just automatically dug everything back in.
How about pest control? Did you have any of the, pest control means
not
then?
Not as it is today. funnily enough, I had a letter from a colleague of mine from those days, recently, and she was talking about pest and disease control, and she said, she was saying in her letter, when you think how we used to handle tobacco, nicotine, cyanide, we used to just use it. We never thought twice about it. We didn't have masks or anything. We just used whatever was available to deal with things. And now, if you approach anybody with a nicotine shred nowadays, they go straight off the deep end. I have got some in the greenhouse, but. because it's still one of the best things for pests in a greenhouse. And if you're prepared to go to some lengths of signing the poison book, you can get it. But we used to handle all that kind of thing without ever turning a hair. We used a lot of pyrethrum before, pyrethrum powder, against pests. But of course, with the war, that was stopped because a lot of that used to come from Kenya, and that was stopped. And it wasn't till well after the war that we went back to a lot of the inorganic things that we could get in. I mean, nowadays you go along a shelf and it's just full of sprays for this and sprays for that and sprays for something else. But ours was all very basic. You boiled rhubarb leaves and used the juice against green fly. You used salt if you could get it to deal with slugs, slugs and snails. Nicotine would kill off almost anything in a greenhouse. Probably kill off the plants as well if you used it too strong. I don't know. We had Bordeaux mixture, but that I think got very scarce during the war. That's against disease, against funguses, but that got very scarce during the war. We had to use it with great care because there wasn't much. No, I think we just sort of managed.
Was there much innovation because of the scarcity of these goods? You know, do you find people experimented, as you did with your straw, for instance, and tried new things?
Oh, yes, I think there was a fair bit of experimenting that was going on. A farmer or a farmer's wife or a smallholder would have an idea and try something out. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But apart from potato blight, which also affected the tomatoes, apart from that, we were very conscious of the fact that we might get Colorado beetle on potatoes. That was something which everybody was keeping an eye open for, because with so much stuff coming over from America on the least lane sort of racket, there was always a possibility that we would get some Colorado beetles. And they are devastating on a potato crop, so we were always on the lookout for them. And they had to go straight up to the Ministry of Agriculture. If you found one, it had to go straight up to the Ministry of Agriculture to be identified. But even if you knew what it was yourself.
Was there much in the way of literature to help people?
Oh, yes. Masses of leaflets, usually either a single sheet or a fold sheet, on everything under the sun. I've probably still got a lot of them somewhere. Not necessarily horticultural ones, but I've still got some of the wartime cookery ones still. And the radio was full of instruction about doing everything possible. I can't remember who I know Lord Walton was the one who did all the food, but I can't remember who did the agriculture. We must have had people doing agriculture on the radio, telling us what to do and what not to do. Of course we did. I can't remember who they were, but we had them before the war, because we had Mr. Middleton before the war. Did you ever hear of Mr. Middleton? Oh, I say Mr. Middleton was a legend in his time. He was the first of the radio gardening talkers. And he used to have about 20 minutes or something, once or twice a week. And I have a feeling that he might have gone on into the early days of the war. But Mr. Middleton was, he was just a household name, Mr. Middleton, Mr. Middleton, Mr. Middleton. Like Jeff Hamilton was a few years ago. And I'm sure we had leaflets on it. We had leaflets on everything under the sun that would help us to produce more food of various sorts. Limited by the amount of paper that there was available, so that they were usually fairly sort of small things that came out. I could probably, if you do want to come another time, I could probably find some of them.
Well, that would be very interesting, you know, to actually see them. Mm. Did you have much in the way of power, you know, when you went about? You were saying about your allotments.
I could pull down the weight of the county on an area of allotments that wasn't doing very well. I don't know what happened as a result of it, because you didn't very often come across it. Most people, allotments were at a premium in almost every place for people who wanted to grow more food. And you see, one of the things that, particularly in a rural county like Wiltshire, was that because there was a war on and food was scarce, one suddenly discovered that one had dozens of relations that you'd never heard of before who lived in towns, and who suddenly realised that they'd got lovely relations living out in the country who had eggs and apples and potatoes. And there was always an incentive to grow more, and there were very few allotments that weren't fully taken up. I can remember one lot that I had trouble with. That was in Covent. The allotments soon after the war were used for housing development, but we did have trouble with those. The local people just wouldn't, for some reason or other. But usually there wasn't very much problem. And you had to always let the parish clerk know that you were coming. And nine times out of ten, he'd meet you there and come and have a look at them, and then you could talk to him about them. I think there was quite a lot of power about proper use of greenhouses, and that didn't affect me. I wasn't involved in proper use of greenhouses so much, because that was done usually on a big commercial scale, and Corby and a man used to look after that.
I was wondering also, you know, the big stately home, the garden you worked in, what would have happened to an outfit like that in the war?
Oh, the vegetable side of it went entirely into vegetable production, and a lot of the more frivolous things tended to suffer. I have a feeling that Wilton Park almost immediately got rid of its vineries, because that was considered to be a frivol fruit.
Is that what you called them, frivol? Was that a term you used, was it?
I think that's probably my thing of it. And I've got an idea that the that the cucumber houses mostly endemic tomatoes, the vineries certainly endemic tomatoes, and I think most of the stately homes really did pull their weight over it. A lot of it would probably go to either to schools or to a lot of the food would probably either go to school. A lot of state homes, of course, turned themselves into schools or hospitals or something, you see, so that a lot of it went back into the house anyway.